This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Our first question comes from Peter Ellinger, who asks, I am particularly interested in the method of measuring distances using a supernova's photosphere and the angle this subtends. I listened to a podcast in which an astronomer detected the light from an ancient supernova by reflection from a nebula and had determined various properties in the supernova explosion. I wondered if this could form the base of a triangle used to measure distance, perhaps light years across, and make more accurate measurements of cosmic distance. I found a reference to supernova 1987A in this method.
That's a good question. In theory, you certainly can use methods like this, but the difference between theory and practice is rarely as big as it is in cosmology. So, as you found, this method has been used on supernovae, nearby supernovae. And just essentially by measuring the time it takes between a flash and the reflection of that flash and using that as one end of a triangle, and then we can look at the distance between those two things as an angle and convert those things, and that gives us a relationship between sort of distance and angle, which is what we're looking for in cosmology. Unfortunately, that doesn't really extend to much larger distances. So 1987A was a very close by supernova. When we're talking about cosmological distances, we really do want to get to hundreds of millions or billions of light years away. And the problem with this kind of method for much longer objects, much greater distances, is that as you go further away, obviously objects get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, just as their light spreads out across the universe. And consequently, the reflection, which is always dimmer than the initial brightness, is even harder to see. So it gets very, very hard to observe that kind of effect for very great distances. Also, if we want to make a very large triangle at great distances, we have to wait an inordinately long time between the flash and the reflection, because if that's going to be, 1,000 light years away, we have to wait 1,000 years between the flash and the reflection to come to us.
So if the distance between sort of the flash and the reflection was 1,000 light years, we'd have to wait 1,000 years.
Exactly, yes, for the difference between those two things. So that's really not going to be a thing we can do in a practical sense. The other thing you need is, if you want a smaller triangle, which would still be useful, you need extraordinary resolution in your telescope to be able to tell the difference between the flash and the reflection, just because those are very close by. And typically, flashes and things like supernovae that are bright enough to be seen at cosmological distances also completely blot out anything in the same area as them. So when a supernova goes off in a distant galaxy, it's typically brighter than the whole rest of the galaxy put together. It's an enormously powerful flash. That's gonna make you block out anything similar. So I think it's a kind of a non-starter, that idea, but there is a similar idea that's sort of related. Actually, two similar ideas. One is called reverberation mapping, which is when we map active galactic nuclei, which are things in the cores of galaxies, which are inordinately bright in the radio and some of the frequencies as well. And we can map the structure of those things using this kind of effect, using reflections. So that's one area this works in. The other area that this does work in is to do with lenses. So as I talked about in the May Extra episode, we can look at the lensing of giant objects of the light that comes past them. So we can look at two paths of light going round a giant cluster of galaxies, and those two paths of light are both bent in different distances and different directions. And we can use the difference between the length of those two light paths in the two different images, the different lens images of the galaxy, to give us a similar kind of triangle, to give us more information in our cosmological distance. So it does work in that situation.
That's really, really cool. Our second question comes from Andrew Celentano, who asks, I was intrigued by your discussion on detecting dark matter and dark energy via the lensing phenomena that Einstein predicted. But how can this be done when there are so many masses between the observer and the most distant galaxies?
This is another very good spot of a kind of interesting detail of how we do this kind of measurement. So whenever we see an object being lensed, whenever we see an object affected by gravitational lensing, there's a bunch of different things between us and that object. So a bunch of different bits of dark matter have lensed that object. So really when we see a given object, what we're seeing is not the lensing from one particular point, it's a kind of total effect, in what we call integrated effect, over the whole line of sight between us and that object. So the light's been bent forward and backward and left and right by all different bits of light along that path. So what we see is not is a kind of statistical or an overall average of the dark matter between us and the object. But the important part is it's not an even average, it's not evenly weighted. So if you think of having a magnifying glass in your hand and you want to look at something, if you want to make the thing look as big as possible, you have to put the magnifying glass exactly halfway between you and the thing you're looking at. And that's the way that magnifies the thing most. And exactly the same thing happens in cosmology. The things between us and an object that lens it most are things halfway along. So when we make a map of lensing, we're making a map of matter halfway between us and the thing. Now, that's not perfect. We're really making a kind of smeared out map of things between us and it. But we do still, if we have enough objects at different distances, so we look at some objects, you know, a million light years away, some 1.1 million and so forth, we can make a sort of pseudo 3D. So still very smeared out, but a sort of pseudo 3D map of the universe like that.
Cool. And our next question comes from Randy Taylor, who asks, I'm sure I don't grasp all the issues involved with forming early supermassive black holes, but from listening to the Jodcast and other podcasts, no one ever discusses dark matter as a source for the mass to create these. Jodcast segments have discussed the problems with forming these black holes as would exist for forming large stars, radiation pressure preventing collapse of enough gas into the forming star to grow to the size observed. But since dark matter only interacts through gravity, and it comprises 25% of the matter of the universe, it could collapse and not be affected by outward radiation pressure. It seems this is a pretty straightforward way to create a very large object quickly in the early universe.
Yes, it's another interesting question about the physics of dark matter and how it works. And this is a kind of slightly subtle question, so it's a good question. So despite dark matter forming the bulk of the matter in the universe and the backbone of the structure of the universe, dark matter does not collapse to form very high density objects in the same way ordinary matter does. So for example, in ordinary matter, we get stars and black holes. Dark matter doesn't create that kind of thing. And the reason why it's kind of interesting, it's to do with angular momentum and loss of energy. So think about a black hole with an accretion disk around it. Think about things flowing into a black hole via, as they swirl around and come into the centre of a black hole. So we can see those accretion disks because they're emitting a huge amount of energy. They're very bright, and they're bright because they're hot. So things swirl around an accretion disk, and the friction, the pressure in the accretion disk heats up and emits light. And that's how they lose energy. So that's how stuff loses energy, so it can collapse further inwards.
So it loses it via friction?
Via friction and then heating and then emission of that heat into outer space. So it has to lose energy somehow is the point. If the accretion disk didn't lose any energy, it would just swirl around and around and around the black hole forever because it would have enough energy to keep going round. So it has to lose energy before it can collapse further inwards. And it loses that exactly by friction. Dark matter is different. Because dark matter doesn't interact by friction, it only interacts by gravity, it can't lose energy in the same way that ordinary matter can. So if you think of a cloud of particles that you had in the universe, if that was ordinary matter, that cloud would collapse a little bit, and then it would start to heat up. And then it would emit that energy as heat, which would let it collapse even further. So you can keep collapsing if your matter until you get to the point where that heat is powerful enough that it reacts against or opposes completely gravity, so it stops you collapsing any further. Dark matter just can't do that. It collapses somewhat, and then it just keeps swirling around itself, unable to lose any energy, to emit any energy by heat, and form even tighter structures. So we just don't see collapsed dark matter structure or you know, highly collapsed dark matter structure.
It's really interesting how different it is from normal matter.
It is completely different, yeah, and it doesn't. It's a very strange idea. The weirdest thing is if you imagine a kind of a cloud of dark matter kind of crashing into another cloud of dark matter, they just go right past each other, they go right through each other. So clouds of dark matter can't collide in any way. And we actually see that in some of the most famous dark matter images, like the bullet cluster is a famous image of a dark matter detection. And that's just two enormous, you know, cluster-sized amounts of dark energy, which if they were ordinary matter, if they were gas, would just smash each other and cause enormous amounts of heat. But because their dark matter just goes right through each other and completely ignore each other. So it sort of ignores itself, dark matter is, I think, the way to think of that.
That's amazing.
Cool.
And our final question comes from Stephen Witty, who asks, as you see something moving closer to the speed of light, it appears to experience time slower. At the speed of light, time stops. So from the perspective of a particle of light, time stops. Say a photon is emitted at last scattering and travels across the universe, only to be absorbed by a detector on the Planck satellite. From the perspective of the photon, it doesn't take 13.75 billion years. It is instantly emitted, then absorbed. But photons oscillate. How do they do that?
That's a very good question, a really hard question as well. So this question cuts to the kind of heart of the duality of light, so the wave-particle description of light, the fact that light is both a wave and a particle. Photons themselves, the particle of light, do not oscillate. Photons are genuinely unchanging and timeless. The photon does not know, well, it doesn't know anything, but the photon does not know that any time has passed for it whatsoever between its emission and when it gets received, no matter if that's across the entire history of the universe. And that's very important. People look for change in light, so people look for evolution in photons. and haven't found any. But if they did find some, that would be evidence that photons were not actually moving at the speed of light, that they had mass.
Now, so they'd have to be moving slightly slower than the
speed of light. Exactly, they'd have to be slower than the speed of light. And we looked at neutrinos and did find that effect. So people looked at neutrinos, and as far as we could detect, they were moving at the speed of light, because it must be very, very close to the speed of light. But they were observed to be mutating. So neutrinos were observed to be changing over the time of their flight. And that's a really important. That's a direct evidence of the fact that neutrinos must have some mass and therefore be moving at slightly less than the speed of light. So it's a really important fact, and it's genuinely true. But there's another description of light, not as particles but as waves. And in this description, the things that we call photons are really particle-like perturbations or effects, descriptions of a behaviour in a wave. And that wave is a wave in the electrical and magnetic fields that permeate all space. And in that description, there is such a thing as oscillation. So that's what's oscillating. But you can't think of a photon as just a lump of light, a particle of light. In the more subtle description that kind of quantum mechanics gives us, and it's a thing called second quantization, if you're a real sucker for mathematical articles on Wikipedia. but if you're looking at the more real description, it's a kind of hybrid between those two things.
Okay, so light is much more complicated than we may think of initially.
Exactly, and you really can't have an intuitive picture of light. Doesn't work.
Good to know. And if you have any astronomical questions that you want answering, then send them in via all the usual channels. Thank you very much.
Thank you.